Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. We are back in session for the 2022-23 school year, and we're taking really big educational topics that have been in my newscast, and we're breaking them down, doing a deeper dive with some of the experts across Connecticut. And this morning, I am very honored to have on the show for the first time, John Hipscher. He is the Chief Operating Officer from M&J Bus and the Vice President for Connecticut School Transportation Association, also known as COSTA. John, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa. Welcome. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, a big topic that many people have been talking about, not just really this past school year, but in the past few years, especially, are school bus driver shortages. Could you kind of give us a snapshot of where we're at here in Connecticut?
Yes, happy to. We're still, all of us, school bus companies are short. And I think in Connecticut there are 169 towns or so, and the majority have a private contractor that is providing their school busing. And even if a town is doing their own busing still, every location, everybody needs to hire. We're all still short drivers.
What's going on, John? Why has this been such a phenomenon? For, like I said, I can remember reporting in Vermont, 10 years ago about school bus driver shortages. So it's not just here in Connecticut, it's across the country. What's the deal?
Well, this shortage has been building for a number of years, even prior to COVID. I think that there were some barriers to entry going back, 5, 10, 15 years, one of which being the length of time that it would take to get your CDL and the background check process. When folks are looking to either switch careers or start a new career, you need to be, you want to work and make money right away. And historically, the amount of time that it took to get licensed delayed you getting a paycheck for maybe 8 to 12 weeks. And that's a big, tough entry for folks to swallow to try to join this business. Now, in recent years, specifically the last year on this licensing process, COSTA specifically has had a great collaboration going on with the Commissioner of the Department of Motor Vehicles, Commissioner Magubani, and her team in terms of speeding up that background check process. So now, somebody starting from scratch to go through the whole CDL permit and training process to get their license, you're shortened up substantially to maybe 4 to 5 week period, which is a lot more attractive. So that helps. But we're also short. Then you get to the pandemic because a lot of folks, decided to, leave the industry, not just ours, many, of course, and haven't maybe returned to the workforce. And I think that all of us in our lives are seeing that there are a lot of people out there that just don't want to work right now.
Now, what I think is interesting, going back to the licensing, this is the same license you would have to use if you wanted to be like a truck driver, right?
That's correct. And something that we've been pushing in the school bus industry is to have a licensing. And this crosses, federal and state requirements. So we would really like to have a licensing program that is just geared towards school bus, school bus CDL. And that will really narrow down the risk of us spending the time to, meet a prospective driver, vet them through the background process, train them, and then maybe we lose them after they get their CDL, because a lot does go into this, behind the scenes. And that's very frustrating. And if you, when all of us gain one driver within our ranks, no matter where the location is, we really crow about it and share it amongst our whole network, because it's another piece that is someone that's filling in an open run someplace. So we all get excited, just as we equally all get frustrated if we have somebody that takes advantage of us like that.
John Hipscher is here, the Chief Operating Officer from M&J Bus and the Vice President for COSTA, which stands for Connecticut School Transportation Association. And we're talking about school bus driver shortages. It's something that Connecticut and many other states across the country have been plagued with. And kind of back to that question of the truck drivers, and maybe you can't answer this, John, so that's okay. But like, are truck drivers seeing the same sort of shortages as school bus drivers are? Because I haven't heard much about them. I'm not saying they're not overworked, but like, is this an issue that the truck driving industry is also seeing?
Well, I would speculate that yes. I don't know for sure, but just, driving around in my own everyday life and from location to location work-wise, you do see that there are many, you know, businesses that are looking for any kind of driver or any kind of employment. So I can only speculate that that would be the case, yes.
So let's say you want to become a school bus driver. You're listening to this segment this morning. You're like, okay, I could see, you know, doing this. Before we get into, you know, the role of a school bus driver, what that ideal person looks like, would you say that the CDL process, like I know you said it kind of is, it could be tedious for some people, but like, does it cost a lot of money? Because I know from some of our listeners, you know, having to pay to get a job sometimes can be not very attractive.
Well, and all of us try to do something creative to help out those that may need it. So when you meet a prospective applicant that is maybe tight on money at that time, you know, you gain some kind of understanding of what they're like, what their commitment will be during your interview process. And many times all of us are happy to help out, whether we cover a cost of it, whether we cover all of the cost of it, or allow it to be paid over a period of time after you hire them. There's all sorts of creative ways. It really isn't all that terribly expensive to get your to pay for the permits, to pay for the physical. So you're talking several hundred dollars in total. But the beauty of all this is once you get through it, the school bus industry is a very high paying part-time employment opportunity, and you can start to earn a paycheck and pay some of that stuff back.
This morning, we are chatting with John Hipscher, who is the Chief Operating Officer from M&J Bus and also the Vice President for the Connecticut School Transportation Association, also known as COSTA. So really quick, John, I don't think I asked you this question. Who are you servicing in Connecticut? You know, like when you hear those two companies or those two entities, where are you servicing?
So M&J Bus is in North Haven in terms of the New Haven County. We go up the state to Farmington and Suffield and East Granby. And then as you move eastern across the state, that's where our heaviest presence is, from the shoreline border all the way up to the northern border of the state. We have 26 locations in the state of Connecticut and employ over roughly about 600 people.
Okay, so you service an awful lot of communities, essentially. You service
yes,
a lot
do.
Of people. Okay. So the reason I was asking that is because I think you at least could give a better understanding for people who don't know really an awful lot about this industry, let's just say, and they're hearing about this and they're going, okay, I've heard about this shortage. I don't know if I'm really qualified. I don't really know if it's up my alley. You know, you're talking about different school districts that you guys service. You have an idea of bigger ones, smaller ones, the ones in between. What does the job entail? What are you looking for in a driver?
Well, so in terms of the target demographic, it is very broad. We are always looking for younger folks that are just entering the workforce, that are looking for a career opportunity, because even though it can be part-time work, some may just want to drive morning and afternoon, you know, take them into school and bring them home. But there are many opportunities to gain more hours during the day, and that is maybe doing some midday kindergarten runs or taking high school and middle school kids home via late runs later in the afternoon. Plus, there's always a lot of athletics that are going on three seasons during the year. So there's potential to make a lot of hours there. We also, a big target audience of ours are retired or semi-retired individuals that are looking to maybe supplement some other part-time work that they're doing, or if they're fully retired, looking to stay busy and have some walking around money. And then another big target of ours is a stay-at-home parent, mom or dad. And that way you can save on your daycare costs, because all of us school bus providers allow you to bring your young preschool age kids on the bus with you. So it's a wonderful way to spend time with them and save on the daycare costs at the same time.
That's really neat. I didn't know that you could bring your kids with you.
It's really a wonderful thing. We always, you know, let our school districts know. That way they are aware of anybody else that's riding the bus in addition to the school kids. But districts welcome that. They're very warm and open to that with all of us. So it's much appreciated, because daycare is a super expensive thing for a lot of people. And this way you can save that cost and have your kids with you.
You know, so I tell this story a lot, John, and I tell it because I don't see this going away in my future. At some point, I do need to get my license for this. But I debated becoming a school bus driver in Vermont when I lived up there as a reporter. But ultimately, I felt awful because when I was going through the application process, I couldn't commit to certain days because I was a reporter. So my hours changed constantly. And I was like, you know, one day I will do it. Because I just think, man, I'd have the best time. I feel like I would have the best time. And I'd probably want to play Disney songs, but that's a totally different story. You know, but I think when you hear about what the job entails and the flexibility of it and the potential there, especially like you said, for people who are stay-at-home parents, this is an amazing opportunity. Do you think the state of Connecticut does a good enough job advertising for bus drivers, good bus drivers, or do you think we wait until either we have stories like we do now of shortages or horrific stories where unfortunately something happened with one bad school bus driver? Now it's like, oh, we're in desperate need of better drivers. You know, like, do we wait too much, or do you think Connecticut does a good enough job of really advertising the job to people? Because, like, I got to be honest, that's the first time I've heard that Connecticut is like totally open to you bringing your kids with you if they're at that younger age where they can't go to school. I have not heard that before.
Well, let me tell you, a wonderful question. With all due respect to the state, no. I think that I mentioned earlier a great collaboration that we have with the background check process and the licensing that is established with the Motor Vehicle Department, which is just nothing short of impressive and very appreciative. But on a larger scale, I think that the state of Connecticut could absolutely help promote this business and this industry, and maybe even offer up some kind of incentives, tax breaks or something like that for some of the cost that it may take to get your license. Or, you know, just I remember when the pandemic was going on, there was some kind of a bonus that was offered by the state of Connecticut to get, long-term unemployed folks back to work. You know, anything creative like that to spark some interest in the industry, or more feel-good stories, because you are 100% correct. There are too many negative stories that go on.
Yes.
And I don't want to bring one in particular to light, but it just recently this school year, and it didn't affect Connecticut one bit, but, you know, we've been doing promotional events, as, you know, our industry has, through Acosta, to promote this business and promote understanding of us being short drivers with the school administrators and moms and dads. And then, you know, a couple of days after that, after everybody's feeling good about that, there was a problem with a school bus, driver in another state that was made to be a big to-do here in Connecticut, like it was something local here. And nothing gives us more of a black eye when a story like that gets a negative story, gets just such big, you know, exposure.
Publicity, yeah.
Versus some ongoing help, because clearly we've been in a crisis for a long time here now, and it just isn't getting any better. Our efforts are really just kind of helping us to sustain where we are at best. And we still need some ongoing help and some feel-good promotion.
Well, you know what, John? I just came up with an idea right here on the spot, and maybe we do this and we work together off the air, but maybe we try to highlight people's stories. If we could get bus drivers who wanted to just share a few minutes of their time, you know, we get a different bus driver every week or every month to share why they love the job that they do and why they've done it. Maybe we have them tell their stories and we start putting good stories out there. I would love to do that if that's something we could do.
I would love that as well. And, even M&J Bus on our own website, we from time to time do driver spotlights where we will ask a driver in one of our terminals if they will share some of those stories, because we want, as I'm sure all the other school bus companies do as well outside of M&J, we all want everybody to, you know, look us up, check us out, and see on our websites the promotional things that we do, the volunteer things that we do in terms of helping the community, because we are a big part of the fabric of all of these local communities, and we have fun. We work hard, but we like to have some fun things that we do. You know, even M&J Bus from time to time will do like a baking contest in a terminal where everybody bakes a certain kind of pie or a cake or something like that, and a few of us come down from management and we're the judges. You know, all fun things that the drivers really like to be a part of.
I think that's really cool. Yeah. So, John, I really appreciate you giving us your time this morning. Is there a website, again, if people are interested and they want to learn more?
Well, so two things. I would give you the MJ's is mjbusinc.com. And what I would encourage anybody in all of the districts in the state of Connecticut, if you are interested in becoming a driver, stop into your local bus company. They will all welcome you. They will all have someone there present to say hello to you. And that's the best way to introduce yourself. They get a chance to talk with you face-to-face and get that application process going.
Well, John, again, I really appreciate your time. John Hampshire, the Chief Operating Officer from M&J Bus and the Vice President for the CT School Transportation Association, also known as CASTA. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Melissa.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Well, good morning, Greg Dancho. How are you, friend?
Good morning, Melissa. Wow, doesn't it feel like fall today?
Yes, I'm so happy. I love me some good fall. Oh, my goodness. I try to keep my mouth shut all summer long because I know how many people love the summer. But, man, once September gets here, I am just like, yay, my season. Yes, I'm happy.
I got to tell you, I'm opposite of you.
Oh, see, I kept my mouth shut. You had no idea until just now.
Not a big fall person. Not a big fall person.
Oh, all right.
But that's okay. Our summer was great this year, and we appreciate all the guests that we had come. We had a banner year. I think we had a record-breaking year of people visiting the zoo.
Really?
So
that's exciting.
Really appreciate that. Our 100th anniversary, it was really great to have all the people come up and help celebrate our 100th anniversary. So,
and we're not even done yet, guys. Yeah, we're just getting started at the zoo. Come on now. We're 100 years young. So, Greg, you know, one of the things that the zoo really prides itself on, which is why I'm a very proud partner of the zoo, I love the work that you do, is trying to protect species, right? We talk about conservation efforts. We try to talk about getting numbers back up, healthy numbers for different populations. And, you know, it's interesting because you and I have talked about this a few times before, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it this morning and really dive into it again and rediscuss, first of all, what it's doing, but also sort of where we're at and how people can help. So why don't you get us started this morning?
I think we may have mentioned it a few times in the past. However, what's happened now is it's moving forward, which, you know, sometimes when you talk about bills and you talk about things in Congress, you're not usually talking about things moving forward, sad to say. They sometimes languish for quite a while. But
you're right.
Here, this past June, in a bipartisan way, the House of Representatives passed this bill. I mean, they moved this bill forward, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, moved it forward. And now it's going to the Senate. Now, that was bipartisan. Again, seeing something move forward in Congress and bipartisan is usually a big deal. And so we're really hopeful now that this gets to the Senate. They will then pass this in the Senate. And that's going to give approximately $1.4 billion towards recovering habitats, safeguarding habitats and biodiversity and slowing extinction rates. See, a lot of people, when we talk about these things and talk about the zoo, we talk about the animals, one of the words we use is charismatic megavertebrates in zoo world, in zoo terms.
It's a very big word. What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? Charismatic megavertebrates. Well, when you think of a zoo, what do you think of? What's the animal you think of?
You. No, I'm just kidding. Like a tiger, a lion, an elephant.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Big
exactly.
animals. Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly. Charismatic megavertebrates. Mm-hmm. They're animals that people love. They're big. Mega means big. They're charismatic, which means people love them. Just the biggest one, I guess you would think would be the giant panda. You know, is a charismatic megavertebrate. Everybody loves them. You know, when you talk about saving those animals, everybody can get on board.
It's easy. It's easy for people to go, oh, yeah, of course. Yes, of course. Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's true.
When we're talking about brook trout and we're talking about.
People are like, wait, are we struggling in those areas and why does it matter? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, why does it matter? Why does it matter? And one of the things that this bill does, it's for basically for states. And tribal lands to work on conservation of species. And because in the state level, you know, a lot of times a lot of great work is done. and in Connecticut. You know, people see turkey all the time in Connecticut now, right?
Yes.
Turkeys weren't in Connecticut 100 years ago, almost completely wiped out in Connecticut. Were brought back in by state DEP efforts, and now all over the place, right? Deer, again, were given, and now we have deer a lot of places, but deer were struggling for a while. So you're looking at habitat preservation. You're looking at keeping the ecology going for these animals, not necessarily trying to save an animal that's on the brink of extinction. But the whole idea is Recovering Animal America's Wildlife Act is to safeguard those habitats, is to keep those animals from, they're kind of on the teetering on the edge right now, and trying to keep them from rolling over into that critical conservation and extinction mode. Because once it gets to that point, it's very hard to try to bring them back. So why don't we do something now by putting this money into the states and lands to preserve these animals before they get to that critical juncture? They're already getting there. I mean,
we already have
one-third of our...
Yeah. I was going to say, what could Connecticut do, for example? I didn't mean to cut you off, but like that money you're saying, like what could we do?
Well, it goes into habitat preservation.
I see.
Again,
in Connecticut,
and it goes into work with conservation officers and conservation people. We've had a downturn in because of budget crisis and budget things of people actually out there helping protect our wildlife. This would help strengthen that. This would help us, you know, get out there and do more work with those animals that. No, people aren't worried. We just had our Conservation Discovery Corps go out and count mussels, freshwater mussels, which are an endangered, not endangered, but getting to that point of endangered species.
Wow.
And so they're trying to get the numbers up. So by getting these dollars into the states, it becomes a local issue and becomes a local program, which sometimes works a lot better. Grassroots always seems to work a lot better. I love grassroots programs.
Yes.
Especially when you start to involve with families, you get that citizen science programs going together. So once that starts working, I think that's where we work. Peregrine falcon's another bird that again, if you know, it's not a bird that people really know about too much, but it's the fastest animal on the planet. You know, flies the fastest. It can go over 100 miles an hour in its stoop. But not many people know about them. But work within the states, not only Connecticut, but also states around here, peregrine falcons were starting to deteriorate really quickly, and now are coming back. We had peregrine falcons nesting in Bridgeport under the bridges and on the buildings in downtown Bridgeport, which
amazing.
Again, bald eagles nesting. We talked about this before, bald eagles nesting in Bridgeport. You know, that's the kind of thing that with this funding, it helps the states strengthen the wildlife programs and strengthens their keeping these animals, like we always talk about, keeping these animals on our planet.
Mm.
And it also has an economic development basis, too, because there's hunting and there's fishing and there's things of that nature and wildlife photography, which you can see that's gone crazy right now, right? With wildlife photography, you see some wonderful pictures. This helps strengthen that economy also. So it's not just helping the animals. It also helps us.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, really a win-win situation.
I think so, too. And I did cut Greg off before, but he was about to say that one-third of all U.S. wildlife species are already, you know, vulnerable, and nearly 1 million species worldwide are at risk of extinction. So this is a very big deal, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. Greg Dancho is here of the Beardsley Zoo, and we're talking about some bipartisan legislation that's going to mean helping a lot of animals and species out there that are really struggling, not just here in Connecticut, but across really the country, the globe. And Greg, in the past, we've talked about people advocating and going to their local representatives, going to their reps who are, mm-hmm. you know, representing us in Washington. But could you talk about, if you don't mind, for another minute, just talking about other things that we could do? So besides speaking out, obviously, and we're now starting to see things in motion in Washington, D.C., which is great. Could you talk about some of the things that we could be doing at home? Like, so for example, you know, you were talking about some of the species that are struggling, birds, butterflies, bees, things like that. Are there things we could be doing like in an everyday? I know, for example, you and I have talked about, you know, planting certain gardens for our bee populations. Like, what can people do also on their own to help these species out?
Yeah, one of the things you can do mostly is be aware. You know, that's always the key, being aware and get yourself educated on what you can do, because there are so many people who want to help that you have to really be careful sometimes, because sometimes helping can actually hurt.
What do you mean?
So It's like, you know, planting. Sometimes you can plant things that you believe are going to be good pollinator things because you may have read it someplace, and it turns out it takes over your yard and does not do a good thing for the animals themselves.
I gotcha.
So really educating yourself is really important. And there's so many websites out there now. I mean, years ago, you didn't have that the plethora of information that you can get really at your fingertips on how these things can be helped. A lot of areas are looking for support. I mean, I know the Audubons are always looking for volunteers to help, you know, with their lands that they have, to help them clear them out and keep them. So if you don't have the property yourself, you can go help those organizations that already are the land conservancies that have lands that can be helped move, keep them clean and do pollinator gardens. I know in Stratford, we're starting to do pollinator gardens all over the place, which is a great thing, being on the pollinator pathway. And really it's getting out there and seeing what there is to help with. I think contacting the local conservation authorities, contacting DEEP. I've mentioned this before. There's lots of studies out there that we can do citizen science on chimney swifts, counting chimney swifts, counting horseshoe crabs. If you're out there in nature, you can also help the scientists and the biologists and the conservationists help get their information that makes them have good choices down the road. So those are all the kind of things you can do to help. And then, again, watch what's going on up in Hartford. The bills are always out there. If you're really into looking into the bills, it's not the most exciting thing in the world to do. But if you want to look at those, you can check those bills that are coming up and see you can drum support from. And why this is important that we're talking about this morning is because this can actually happen this fall. This can be voted on this fall, and it's not a new tax. It's money that's already being accrued. It's just now taking the money and putting it towards something in a manner that will be there. It's not going to be something that it's subject to whim back and forth. It's going to be there so states know they have the money to work with this, which is vitally important. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go on to any of the wildlife organizations, the National Wildlife Federation, National Wildlife Foundation's website, the other websites, wildlife.org, they all have information that you can just do the real easy click, point on it, click it, support it. They'll send it right to your state senators, to your federal senators, and they'll get the information. So it's Senate Bill 2372, which is what this bill is. And again, we're kind of pushing for it. We'd like to see it done as a nice early Christmas gift this year.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. And Greg Dancho, I really appreciate that you are an advocate and that you come on this show every week and that we talk about really important topics like this. Thank you so much for today's Zoo Minute.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you very soon. That's Greg Dancho of the Beardsley Zoo here on WICC. This was a story we talked about in news around the region earlier this week. An Oklahoma news anchor is recovering after she started showing signs of a stroke while on air over the weekend. Her name was Julie Chin. She's with an NBC affiliate news station, and she started kind of losing her vision in part of her eye, and then her hand and her arm went numb. And as she was doing her segment on air, she had difficulty reading the teleprompter. Luckily, she was able to recover pretty quickly and finish the show. But not so many people are as lucky as Julie Chin are. Her doctor said she showed the beginning stages of stroke. And interestingly enough, some statistics that came out after that are pretty alarming, especially when it talks about stroke and women in the United States. So I wanted to talk about it here on the show this morning. And we have neurologist Dr. Kelly Matmati, who is here with the stroke program. She's actually the stroke program director with the Neuroscience Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. So Dr. Matmati, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning.
Can you tell us, Dr. Matmati, about, so in this situation, again, this person showed beginning stages of stroke. How often does that happen? Like, what stopped her from having a full-blown stroke? I know she's not one of your patients, but I've never heard of, like, beginning stages. Usually you just hear about people having a stroke.
Well, she certainly was having stroke symptoms. So loss of vision on one side and speech difficulty are symptoms of stroke. And she went to the hospital quickly. Her colleagues recognized the symptoms and called 911 and had her brought to the hospital. I don't know what treatment she received, but she recovered pretty quickly, it seems. So you know, this may have been a stroke, or it may have been something we call a TIA for transient ischemic attack. TIA really is the same thing as a stroke. It's just that the symptoms get better. So to me, stroke and TIA are the same thing, and this anchor was having stroke symptoms.
So why do you think that happened? Maybe not for her, but in general, why do strokes happen?
So the main risk factors for stroke include high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, and, you know, and age. And so the more risk factors that you have, the more your risk of stroke increases. And there's also specific causes of stroke, like atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heart rhythm, and other heart problems that can increase your risk of stroke.
You know, this person was very lucky because she obviously was on television and she had a lot of people watching her at the time. But I've heard in my years of reporting, Dr. Matt Matty, there have been people who are in bed watching TV, their spouse is downstairs making dinner or something, and they're having a stroke and they can't yell out. And I guess that's sort of my question is, you know, in this situation, this woman was very lucky because she was being watched by a lot of people at one time, but not as many people are as lucky. Are there things that we could do to alert someone that we that something is very wrong and that we could be having a stroke?
So, you know, fortunately, people having strokes are typically alert and awake. And so they, you know, they are able to request for help usually. Even if they're having speech problems, you know, they can alert a family member that they're, you know, experiencing something. And, you know, if those symptoms are recognized, it is important that you call 911 so you can get to the hospital right away. And we recommend calling 911 over just getting in the car and driving, because when you arrive in the ambulance, the EMS personnel can alert the emergency room so they can be ready for you and take you right in and get you the treatment that you need.
That's a good point. And I'm curious, Dr. Matt Matty, what are some signs? You know, in this situation, you said that the people who saw this anchor going through it, they kind of knew the signs. They knew she's having, you know, something bad is happening right now. If you've never experienced a stroke, like I myself have never experienced one before, and I think a lot of times we as humans just kind of panic and go, what the heck is going on? I'm losing, you know, feeling somewhere, or I can't see out of my eye. And you start to panic and you may not even make sense of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 at that moment. What are things that we should look out for that we're like, wow, I'm experiencing a stroke. This is going to get bad. I need to go to a doctor immediately.
Sure. First of all, the stroke is sudden onset. So these are all symptoms that would come on suddenly, kind of out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
We can use an acronym BFAST to remember some of the common symptoms of stroke. And that it stands for balance, problems with your balance or dizziness. Eyes, so changes in your vision or double vision. Face is for a droop on one side of the face. Arm, A is for arm, which is arm weakness or leg weakness. S is for speech, for speech changes, like difficulty getting your words out or slurred speech. And then T is for time, which means time to call 911. So that's a handy acronym that you can use to remember those symptoms.
Is there anything we could do to prevent having a stroke?
I would say the number one thing is to go to your primary care doctor regularly, get screened for things like high blood pressure and diabetes and high cholesterol. And if you have those things, get treated for it. I see a lot of patients who think that they're healthy, but they come in with a stroke and we find out that they've had high blood pressure and diabetes for many years and they didn't know it. So it's really important to get screened for those things and to get treated.
What is the average stroke patient age? Like, can somebody in their 20s or 30s have a stroke, or is it typically, you know, like a 50 plus?
So most stroke patients are older than 65, but there are quite a few that are younger than that. I think I saw recently 38% of strokes occur in patients younger than 65. So, you know, we're seeing more of those traditional risk factors in younger people, like the high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. But there's also some specific causes of stroke that are more common in younger people, like certain heart conditions, and other things that are a little more rare.
Dr. Kelly Matt-Matty, the stroke program director at St. Vincent's Medical Center, we really appreciate you coming on. And of course, if you would like to learn more about this, go to hartfordhealthcare.org/stroke. And I believe, Dr. Matt-Matty, you are coming back on next month to talk about a stroke symposium that's going to be going on. So I look forward to having you back on the show really soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Matt-Matty here on WICC.